The initial kind of first best optimization that businesses have is to say, how do I make the absolute most money I can from the resources that I directly have? You know, I've got a power station, I've got a gas contract, how do I make the most gross margin out of the electricity today and tomorrow?
Hi everyone, welcome to the NZX podcast. I'm Courtney Holden, and in today's episode, Matt Manning is joined by Bruce Turner for a chat on central portfolio management. But to kick things off, I'm joined by dairy analyst Alex Winning for an update on global dairy markets. Hey, Alex, thanks for joining us today. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pretty crazy time in dairy at the moment. Dairy prices fell 7.4% at the latest GDT auction to a nearly five-year low. What's going on? Why is demand so low at the moment?
Yeah, demand is definitely low right now. We're in a perfect storm of increased global supply and increased economic uncertainty. With dairy being a premium product for much of the world, increased inflation, interest rates, currency fluctuations, they're all holding spending on those premium products for a large percentage of the global population. This is the case particularly in regards to China, who are facing record youth unemployment rates, inability to pay off debt for many large businesses and banks, and deflation in their economy. And furthermore, Chinese production of dairy has or had continued to increase over the 12 months up to June, with production only just pulling back in this recent month.
So with Chinese milk production dipping in June, are we likely to see a shift? Would their demand for export product increase?
Yeah, with Chinese milk production starting to dip and the tariff coming off for New Zealand dairy in January, the market is hopeful that China will return to the fold. I'm both optimistic and pessimistic in this regard. You know, I want China to import more New Zealand dairy. I am obviously a Kiwi, so for our economy, that would be great. However, you know, Chinese inventory is so high, and as a result, it would take a massive increase in consumption to change that current status of Chinese imports. That being said, China has just announced an economic stimulus package, and that in history has improved domestic consumption. So there is hope.
And the SGX NZX derivatives prices for the front whole milk powder contracts have dropped below 2600. Do you expect that prices will continue to fall further for the rest of 2023?
Yeah, well, that is the magic question. Right now, it is really difficult to say. Fonterra has added more volume on the GDT for the next couple months with regards to whole milk powder and S&P. And with supply levels high and demand levels low, I find it hard to see prices moving in an upwards trajectory. Had you asked me a couple of days ago whether I thought I could see whole milk powder dipping below 2600, I would have said no. But now that it has, the possibilities are endless.
Yeah, I think we'll all be keeping a pretty close eye on prices over the next few months. That's great insight, Alex. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, Matt and Bruce talk central portfolio management.
Welcome back, everyone. We're now joined by Bruce Turner. How are you going, Bruce?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Matt. Great to be here. Great to have the opportunity to talk about central portfolio management.
Great. Okay, let's jump straight into it. So we've gone through a bit of information about your current roles. You're on multiple boards, and you're now a strategic advisor for Fonterra. Before you came to Fonterra, what sort of expertise and experience did you bring to the table? Would you mind telling us a bit about your background, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks very much. Yeah, so before I joined Fonterra, I was in the energy industry for 30 plus years. Like many people in the energy industry, started on the engineering side. And in engineering, it's very much around allocation of scarce resources, using scarce resources, but doing it in a very cost-effective way. So I thought always about cost plus. And in those businesses, money tends to be one of the scarcest resources of all. And so that tended to get me thinking not only about cost, but about value. And then I was lucky enough to have a boss who encouraged me to do some formal commercial study. So I actually went back to university and did an economics degree majoring in public policy. And in that, learned a lot about markets, industry organization, and thinking about value rather than cost and about creating value. Then New Zealand was undergoing a lot of economic reforms in the 1980s, and that included the liberalisation of industries. The energy industry got broken up and market was created. When you have markets, you have risk, but you also have opportunity. That took us on the journey of thinking about how do we use these markets to our advantage. And out of that sort of grew that thinking about centralizing decision-making about risk management, but also taking opportunities that were available when you had these markets and opportunity to use the financial side as well as purely physical dispatch. So I ended up moving from electricity distribution business into an electricity generator, and that electricity generator became vertically integrated with a retail business. So we had a generation portfolio, we had a retail portfolio, and the beginnings of a financial market with a fairly vibrant contract for differences or swaps market developing. And so looking at kind of all of those elements, how do we bring them together? How do we optimize, make the most of the choices available to us? And that was sort of beginnings of that centralized portfolio management or risk management business model. And at the same time, you know, we saw the formation of Enron, who were extremely good at many things that they did around trading and portfolio management, but you know, history shows they let themselves down a lot too on some of the other transactions that they did. But the whole electricity, gas, sort of pipeline, LNG businesses, they were all evolving and making more and more use of financial markets. So I went from New Zealand to Singapore, built a big cogeneration station on Jurong Island. I think it's the most energy dense footprint of a power station, 800 megawatts on a very small site. Seawater cooling, a really interesting project. Undersea gas pipeline from West Natuna gas field into Singapore. We had an electricity business, a gas business, and a utilities business, helping our customers with steam, medium heat, steam, demineralized water for their industrial processes. So suddenly you've got this whole portfolio of assets, all of these positions, gas contracts that look like oil contracts, the ability to trade contracts for differences market for the natural gas emerging in Singapore, albeit in the guise of HSFO, you know, high sulfur fuel oil swaps market. Electricity contracts for differences, and then very much sort of thinking about how do you use all these different elements, the power station business, the gas business, the utility business, the flex that we had in our natural gas contracts, the spot market and contract opportunities that we had. And you begin to think sometimes it was more valuable to sell the natural gas than to actually burn it in the power station. So you begin to think about some of the different optimizations. The initial kind of first best optimization that businesses have is to say, how do I make the absolute most money I can from the resources that I directly have? You know, I've got a power station, I've got a gas contract, how do I make the most gross margin out of the electricity today and tomorrow? Then you sort of think, well, maybe there's more money to be made by some days just selling the natural gas. And so that's a make or buy, use or sell type optimization. We could go to a cheap spot market and fulfill our contract obligations to our customers and get more money by selling the gas to the big oil refinery up the road, which was making it into feedstock for some of their value-added products. And so you're bringing these elements together. And then as the financial market got more and more liquid, there's also those opportunities there. And at the end of my stint in Singapore, at that stage I was working for Suez Energy International, who's now called ENGIE, and they moved me to Brussels, where I was Senior Vice President of Trading and Portfolio Management. And there we had a much broader portfolio. We had the Benelux generation assets, but also generation assets right through France, the Iberian Peninsula, and into Eastern Europe, Germany. Coal, natural gas, nuclear, pump storage, hydro, LNG contracts. And inside a lot of those contracts were choices. And if you're thinking about choices from a trading perspective, choices are options. And so it's like, how do you monetize the value of those options and take that portfolio management to the next level of sophistication by using the financial markets to get not only the extrinsic value of those financial options, but as well as the intrinsic value. And so just that it was a gradual journey. By then, the consultants like McKinsey, Arthur D. Little, were talking about this energy treasury or risk management business model as a kind of a way of extracting the value from all those different value pools there. So central portfolio management is kind of a business model or a framework. It is something that lets organizations kind of make the most of the choices they have through central oversight and direction of how the different parts of the portfolio are used.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And bringing that experience forward to the role you ended up in at Fonterra as director of central portfolio management and trading. How you briefly touched on then how there were some similarities as far as product optimization goes when it comes to dairy, quite similar to some elements of what you were just discussing with energy. Were there any other key lessons that you brought through with you to your role at Fonterra?
I think that background and experience in the energy markets is incredibly helpful for dairy. Milk processing is essentially taking a highly valuable feedstock, milk, and then deciding, what do I make that milk into? How do I sell it? Who do I sell it to? Where do I sell it? So choices around what products, Fonterra calls that product mix optimization. Also choices around the selling strategy and how to keep close to the market or to sell forward. Not dissimilar to a flexible oil refinery where you've got a highly valuable feedstock called oil and choices around whether you refine that oil into gasoline, kerosene, diesel, some of the highly sort of valuable lubricants, so, you know, the primary streams, the secondary streams, tertiary streams. So you can learn a lot about the model by looking at a more mature industry and how that's grown and evolved over time. So the economics of product mix optimization are actually pretty well established. They're widely known, and there's some very, very good advisors out there who can talk about that. And that's whether you're turning oil into products, milk into products, feed a cattle into cuts in a supermarket, chicken processing. Some of the experts, they tend to refer to that as disassembly economics. You know, you're taking something and you're breaking it down into its most valuable use. Quite different from a manufacturing business where you're taking a lot of different raw materials that are discrete and then you're turning them into a finished good. Here the finished good is from breaking down a feedstock. So look at that, then you'd say, well, you know, who would be the leaders in trading and portfolio management in those mature industries? And look to companies like BP, Shell, you know, Total, some of the Europeans, a very, very vibrant ecosystem around energy as well. You know, you've got all of the large investment banks with expertise around commodity research and energy freely available. You've got International Energy Agency, so some of those sort of third parties. So lots of information about that and looking at the way in which they create value. So generally, they've got the most efficient use of their refineries, if you will, and very, very good economics about making the finished goods, the most valuable product mix from the refineries, but also the trading dimension as well. And in the trading dimension, you hear a lot about crack spreads, which is referring to the hydrocarbon cracking process, what to make the oil into. And then the natural economics of those is well known by the oil majors, and they know when something's more profitable than its long-run mean value, so, sell the spread, or when to buy it back, and have the opportunity to do that several times over the lifetime of the futures contract. Mm. We did the same thing in gas-fired power stations initially, where we had the electricity market and the gas market. At the time I was there, we knew that needed to make something in the order of 12 to 15 euros a megawatt hour in order to fund the project. So if you saw the spread between the futures price for electricity and the price for gas exceeding that, then you'd say, okay, now's the time to lock in that margin. But that might collapse over time because of the dynamics of supply and demand for both gas and electricity. And so you would have the opportunity to buy that back, take the profit. And you might get to do that two or three times over the lifetime of those futures contracts, because the futures contracts, they might list 3 years into the future. The supply-demand dynamics in markets are always evolving. Mm. And the spreads are always evolving as well. So suddenly you've got this opportunity to not only make the most money from the best dispatch of the power system on the day, but also to get your gross margin more than once through the trading in the financial markets. So that's just one of the value pools that we were seeking to unlock. Another one is looking at the relative risk appetite between the customers and the producers. Kind of one of my general rules, I think, from being around is that commodity prices tend to be log normal. So the high prices far and away exceed the low prices. As a commodity producer, you can always just shut off, sell your feedstock to somebody else or mothball or something like that. You don't have to go deeply negative. Whereas the price spikes to the upside can be really large. That generally tends to mean that to buyers of commodities, risk management should be worth more than to producers. And so there's an opportunity there in a market that's in equilibrium to try and provide structured financial products to help customers manage price risk. And you see that in all different forms of markets. It's one of the core activities of companies like Cargill in commodity markets. The oil majors, the investment banks have all been offering those sorts of products. And again, in dairy, dairy tends to be one of the most volatile commodities. Mm. And so price risk management is an essential tool for farmers, for producers, processors, and for buyers as well. And so the ability to help buyers manage their price risk and to bring that back into a central portfolio that that we then manage for risk within our risk tolerances is again another opportunity in a central portfolio management world to unlock a new value pool.
Brilliant. We're just going to quickly, obviously you spent quite a few years establishing the central portfolio management team as it is today at Fonterra. During that process, it's quite a pivot. You've touched on some elements around how it differs from the traditional business structure that some of these commodity businesses may use. Are there any key hurdles that you faced in establishing the central portfolio management function at Fonterra?
Yeah, lots of lessons along the way. And if I had my time again, I'd I'd probably do things slightly differently. There's sort of multiple pillars to it. One is kind of establishing the, you know, the sort of leading practices, should we call them institutions or functions inside the business. Things like a risk management committee to bring transparency and oversight to what you're doing. Good risk management policies and procedures, and making sure that those are very, very tightly lined up with the board's risk appetite. So the board's has ultimate oversight and responsibility for the business, and they will articulate what their risk appetite is in terms of the different things. Health and safety, they will generally have an extremely low risk appetite, whereas a dairy company might have a more open risk appetite for things like exposure to dairy prices.
Mm.
So you sort of make sure that the policies and procedures very tightly link back to that, so that you're not getting out of whack with what the organisation wants in that regard. So those are the building blocks, and they're what sort of helps empower the team. You know, they're operating within a framework. There's clearly defined roles and responsibilities and delegated authorities.
Yep.
But then there's the transformation journey, you know, taking the organization on that journey. Prior to sort of implementing something like a centralized portfolio management model, it's quite typical to see that the sales teams would be hugely empowered in terms of pricing, price levels, price structures, things like that. And so to sort of start taking some of that responsibility away from them and sort of setting up a more formal governance around price structures, price indices, you know, it's a tough transformation journey.
Mm.
And so it has to be done in a way that empowers the sales guys or the sales teams to do the absolute best for their customers and meet their customers' needs, but also balance that with the organization's needs and the opportunities to make money.
Mm.
So one of the things that we did as an example inside Fonterra was that with the establishment of GDT in 2008 and then the evolving credibility of the prices from GDT, and in 2010, the launch of the NZX whole milk powder futures initially, followed by skim butter and AMF, we moved our contracting index to the GDT indices. And so we kind of centralized that exposure and concentrated around the GDT prices. And you see similar sort of things in the energy industry. When I was in Singapore, we would sell in a number of different ways, but generally indexed to the Singapore spot market for electricity, or we would do fuel oil index contracts. So basically the customer took the price risk on our fuel, and we got a secure margin that covered the cost of operating our plant and gave us a return on capital. And that's an incredibly good risk management tool because we had customers who were in the energy industry who had opposite kind of fuel oil type exposures, things like oil refineries or oil majors.
Mm.
They're like, well, we know how to manage fuel risk. And in fact, this is just an offset for us. So a fuel index contract to them looked like a quite sort of secure fixed price contract. And to us, it was great because we had a secure return for part of our portfolio as well.
How was did you find the basis to be an issue in those structured kind of agreements that you were doing linked to fuel prices?
Basis, yeah, it is an issue. If you both kind of got the same sort of exposure, you know, becomes less of an issue. You know, for example, a seller whose milk price is linked to GDT and a buyer who's buying on GDT, the basis is quite minimal. Mm. In the case in Singapore, our gas contract looked like a high sulfur fuel oil contract linked to Mean of Platts Singapore. And as a consequence of that, most of the companies had oil price risk that we were selling to, sort of general oil risk. But they were sophisticated and mature, the big oil majors, and so they could manage that basis. It exists and it needs to be managed, and sometimes it can be the real sting in the tail. It's kind of eyes wide open on that basis.
Okay, interesting. So finally, let's just wrap this up. Say a company is thinking about adopting a central portfolio management model to start managing price risk within their business. Do you see central portfolio management as a business model to be all in or all out, or do you think it can be implemented partially and in stages and gradually phased in?
I'm a big fan for sort of gradual and taking the organization on the journey. Actually, kind of all in and all out can be extremely disruptive, and can leave people burned, and also create organizational risk, which is sometimes quite hard to manage, that operational risk. Yeah, I think the way to sort of start is to look at sort of the big points of choice, choice around physical products, physical decision making. Often inside an organization, that's something like an S&OP, sales and operations planning function, may even be called in the power industry, you know, sort of dispatch, scheduling and dispatch. Those sort of functions tend to be where the choices around the physical operations are made. And bringing those together and integrating them with some of more of the financial decision making, which could be the commodity price risk management, some of the procurement risk management decisions, starting to bring those together and establishing a sort of a formal governance, getting the transparency about what's going on, seeing where the shocks come from. Are they shocks to sort of rising or falling selling prices, or is it rising or falling cost of goods? And you know, starting to sort of understand that risk management for commodity prices is a pretty straightforward process. It's all about understanding what those risks are, quantifying them, and then figuring out how they can be managed. Because sometimes they can't be. If there's no liquidity in the market, then the best thing you can do is maybe contract that risk away. And many times it's just sort of sits there doing nothing, understanding it and doing nothing is a decision around risk management. And, you know, fully hedging it away is also a decision around risk management. So it's kind of understanding, quantifying, figuring out the best risk management program for the organization, taking very much a portfolio approach. Don't just try and do all of your risk management on one day and then review it a year later. You know, it's very much sort of breaking it down, managing it as a portfolio, piece by piece, day by day, reviewing that, see what worked, see what didn't work, and building and learning from that. Putting the processes in place and communication. I can't overstress the importance of communication across the business, upwards as well. You know, so that the most senior executive and the right parts of the board fully understand what's going on and how it works. No surprises, being transparent and being willing to recognize what works well, but what doesn't work well, and move away from that and try something new.
Fantastic. It's been great having you on, Bruce. Always insightful, always full of a lot of great knowledge from such a great career. So thank you very much for your time today, and thanks everyone for listening. We will see you next time.
Thanks very much, Matt.
The information provided in this podcast is a guide and is intended for general information purposes only.
The information is not investment advice. The information should not be relied upon as a substitute for detailed advice from a professional advisor. The podcast may contain opinions or forward-looking statements, and actual results may vary from what is expressed in this podcast. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the presenter or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of NZX. NZX Limited is not liable for any loss suffered through relying on the information in this podcast. NZX makes no warranties as to the accuracy or completeness of the information in this podcast. All intellectual property rights in the content of this podcast are owned or used under license by NZX, and NZX's written consent is required to use, redistribute, or reproduce the content, or use it to create other works.